On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We look at environmental policy through a new report from the Wisconsin Academy's Climate Critical Lands Project. Our state has 17 million acres of forested land cover. That's nearly half of the total land area of our state. The 41-page report draws on insights from dozens of forestry organizations looking at the future of carbon storage. Join in, 800-642-1234. Paul Cole is tribal forester for the Stockbridge-Munsee community and chair of the Wisconsin Tribal Conservation Advisory Council's Forestry Committee. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Hi.
Good morning. Hello. Lizzie Condon here as well, Environmental Initiatives Director at the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters, co-authored this report. Lizzie, welcome.
Hi. Good morning. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday. You spoke with 57 experts in forestry and related industries for this report, and nearly everyone you talked with said carbon sequestration and storage is A, difficult to understand, B, hard to obtain, or overwhelming. What do people not get? What is the problem here?
I think Paul can probably help me answer that question as well. It seems like there's just an overwhelming amount of information out there about carbon sequestration and storage in forestry. And like many different management strategies, it's really going to depend on the land that you're looking at. So it can be really confusing. Paul, do you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I think that comes with kind of how why it's so confusing is we have so many different forest types, so much land base, and so many different owners that sifting through all the information is very difficult.
So, Lizzie, how important is carbon sequestration, you know, by capturing and storing carbon in Wisconsin forests?
Yeah, so for this report, we were really looking at natural carbon solutions. So that's really just using nature, using our landscapes and enhancing them to increase carbon sequestration and storage. And the good news about doing that is it can also come with a lot of co-benefits. We know that forests help us with air quality, water quality. They provide us with places to recreate. Probably many of us did that over this last weekend, enjoyed some time in a forest. And they also provide great habitat for wildlife. And so the idea is that when we're increasing carbon sequestration and storage in forests, we really have a lot of other benefits that come along with them. Do you want me to talk at all about kind of the basic process of how our forests sequester and store carbon?
Sure. Yes. Go ahead.
Okay, great. So I'm not a forester, so Paul can join in and correct me if I'm wrong, but I just think one of the coolest things about trees and plants in general is that they take carbon from the air, you know, the air that we're breathing, they take carbon and they turn it into biomass. So they turn it into leaves, twigs, their trunks, their roots, and they store that carbon. So they sequester it, they pull it in from the air, and then they store it within their bodies. And then forests become a carbon sink through living biomass. And then once those trees cease living, you know, if they become dead woody matter, that continues to store carbon as it breaks down. Soil in forests stores a lot of carbon as well. Something that I learned more about for this report is that durable wood products, like the wood that you may be sitting in, surrounded in your home, can continue to store carbon as well.
Lizzie Condon there with the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. We have Paul Cole, Stockbridge-Munsee Community Forester, as they collaborated on this new report, Wisconsin's Forested Lands, Opportunities for Carbon Sequestration and Storage. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Paul, the report said tribal nations' forests here in Wisconsin are managed in ways that result in higher rates of carbon sequestration, but it's not something explicitly done. What can Wisconsin learn from and model in tribal forestry practices?
Well, I think tribal forests are very similar to a lot of our public lands, but I think some of The tribal forests out there seem to have a little bit longer rotations and are driven very hard by, you know, limiting fragmentation, trying to keep consolidated blocks of forested lands on the landscape. So, and the way that we're able to manage, in looking at much longer timeframes and say a private landowner that's only going to have that property for maybe a lifetime or two, we're looking at a group of people that are planning to have this chunk of land for, you know, eternity. So the goals can be a little, I wouldn't say loftier, but a little more long-term planning. So I think that helps a lot with the tribal forests.
Something that jumped out to me in this report, when you say longer rotations, you point out that if we didn't harvest Wisconsin trees for a half century, we could sequester the total carbon emissions that Milwaukee County generates on a yearly basis. But then you think about that, but that would decimate the forestry industry. So how do you strike a balance? Paul, you first.
I think that it's important to look at that 50 years is that number's in there because that's kind of where our age of forest is. And in about 50 years, we're going to get to an age where we're sequestering less carbon in our forest than we are today. So I guess that number changes, but how to make the balance, it's very difficult. And it looks at the goals of every forest owner and manager and see what they can do and what they can't. You know, feeding the forest industry in Wisconsin is very important. It's a $26 billion a year industry. It would be good to shut that down. So what can we do? I think replanting things is great. Limiting fragmentation is great. But more than anything, we need a little more knowledge on what's out there and what changes we can make and what benefits those would actually equate to.
Lizzie, what comes up for you when, you know, you hear that statistic of not harvesting Wisconsin trees for a half century?
Yeah, we brought that up just to say that, you know, there is some potential there, but there's a lot of other options. And I think that's something that I learned a lot about in the course of this report, is that it's like there's a huge menu of options that we can choose from to increase carbon sequestration and storage through forestry. Delaying harvest is just one tool. Paul can speak to more specific tools like you know, selective thinning. Even young forests can contribute a lot to carbon sequestration because they have high growth rates. But we also looked at other opportunities like decreasing carbon emissions during the forestry process. A lot of that can come through increasing efficiency in trucking routes. It can come from things like biomass cogeneration plants, you know, using waste biomass to service the needs of saw and pulp mills, you know, their heat and electricity needs. And there's also some interesting new durable wood products like mass timber that could be storing carbon for a long time in buildings like Ascent Milwaukee that some of your listeners may have heard about.
Yes, we talked about Ascent Milwaukee recently, tallest mass timber construction in the world at this point. Lizzie Condon leads environmental initiatives for the Wisconsin Academy. Paul Cole is here, tribal forester for the Stockbridge-Munsee community, guiding us through their new report examining the potential for the forestry industry to further mitigate the effects of climate change. Joined in on carbon from the perspective of private timber landowners, from the milling perspective, carbon credit developers, policy and legislation in the forestry area, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, the State Capitol Report, back in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore the untapped potential in Wisconsin's forest land in mitigating the effects of climate change. 10 recommendations from the Wisconsin Academy in its new report called Wisconsin's Forested Lands. They talked with 57 focus group participants, and that perspective turned out to be very meaningful for the direction of the report. Join in on policy, how to increase carbon sequestration and storage, 800-642-1234. Lizzie Condon heads up environmental initiatives for the Wisconsin Academy. Paul Cole is here, tribal forester for the Stockbridge-Muncie community, with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield, starts us off. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you. As a forest land owner myself, I'm aware of some very disadvantageous tax laws in the state of Wisconsin. Ag lands that's used specifically for row crops gets taxed at an extremely significantly lower rate than forest land. And the incentive, of course, then is to remove the forests and convert it to row crops. And I've witnessed that firsthand. I mean, yes, we have the managed forest law, but it's still much, much more lucrative to plant row crops. It's very specific what crops you can grow in order to get that lower tax rate. And I think we see that on ag land all over the state is a removal of fence rows, removal of little woodlots here and there in order to achieve that more favorable tax rate. And that's a huge problem in this state for the preservation of forest land. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you. Paul, go ahead. And then Lizzie, jump in as well.
Yeah, I can start that. That's a great point. And we've been working and talking with that about that for quite a few years in a couple of different organizations I've worked with. How to change that and get the tax people to look at forested lands like they look at all other egg crops, I'm not sure, but it's a really good point.
Yeah, we did a focus group with small scale private landowners, so kind of family foresters, and they did bring that up as well. They said MFL is great. I like my land to be enrolled in the managed forest law. But sometimes I do look at the tax break that you get from agricultural lands, and I think maybe that would be better. So this is something that we did talk about a bit. We talked about that we could explore some potential tweaks to manage forest law, but another thing that we talked about was just creating a parallel program for tax breaks just for managing for forest carbon. So we suggest that could be a way to continue keeping forested land as forest.
Jeff brings up agriculture, and Republicans in the final days of the session, this past session, introduced a carbon trading bill, a voluntary market for farmers to trade carbon emission offsets and to make it easier for producers to sell renewable gas produced from manure and food waste and so forth. What impact do you think legislation like this would have on carbon storage and sequestration, Paul?
I think that just getting it in the forefront and getting, you know, if two-thirds of our forested land base in Wisconsin is generally private landowners, getting that to the forefront and getting them to understand that they can be part of the solution, and see that there is some monetary incentives to help them do that versus making a different choice.
Lizzie, one recommendation of your report really echoes the governor's task force on climate change. You support exploring the step of designating carbon as a forest product through state law and policy. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that's necessary?
The reason why we stated that we want to explore it is because when we were talking to people about this, we really got a huge diversity of opinions. We got some people who said, it needs to be done. We need to designate carbon as a forest product because under two major state laws, you know, managed forest law and then 2811, which has to do with the administration of county forests, managing for forest products is highly emphasized under both of those laws. And so some people that we talked to said, we need to have carbon designated as a forest product, and that would kind of shift how people are managing their land under those two laws. Other folks that we talked to said actually no changes need to be made, that there is flexibility in the laws as they exist to manage more for carbon. It's really just about educating people more. And some other people that we talked to said that that would actually not be a good thing for those laws, and we should be creating a parallel program. So we really wanted to just kind of dive into that more in the future. I think that, you know, one of our biggest recommendations is the creation of a Wisconsin Forest Carbon Partnership. And folks should come together in that partnership from across the industry, including, you know, small private landowners, larger scale landowners, folks who work for DNR and for tribal nations. Everybody should come together and talk about that sort of thing. You know, what repercussions could making that change have across forestry, and is it positive or negative for carbon sequestration and storage?
Talking about how to reduce climate change through management of our state forests with Lizzie Condon there from the Wisconsin Academy and Stockbridge Muncie Community Forester Paul Cole with us. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Paul, we've heard quite a bit about carbon forest credits. What are your thoughts on corporations buying and trading carbon credits?
Well, I think that the carbon credits are a tool and can have some pretty good benefits, especially when you're looking at fragmentation and keeping forested lands on the landscape for longer periods of time. But there's also some I think, I don't know if it's misconceptions or some other aspects where a lot of the carbon that is being emitted and needing to buy these carbon credits for, they're being created from lands that are already in forested land, and they're not a change happening. So, I mean, if you have a large 1,000-acre block and it's all forested, you can sell a very large amount of credits, but were you going to change your management? Is it really a net gain or not that, you know, you would have kept that carbon in a stored landscape already, but for like large land bases and some of these really large landowners that maybe it's more beneficial to split it up, but if they're able to get carbon credits, maybe they can stay in that landscape for longer. So I think they're a tool, but they should be kind of looked at with a skeptic eye sometimes.
Lizzie, a confusing tool. Your focus groups were also confused over the carbon credit market. What do you think can be done about that?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is that, like Paul said, it's a tool, and it's a tool that is going to be useful in some situations and not in others. We had some of our private landowners saying that they were very curious about this, but they didn't know if they were able to enroll. Other folks that we talked to, like some county foresters, were considering enrollment. And I mean, even just some of the laws around this, and then who needs to make decisions around this? A lot of times it's a county board. Paul can speak to, you know, that tribal councils sometimes need to be involved, that it's not really up to the foresters all the time. A lot of times it's up to folks who are a little higher up on the chain to decide if this is something that they want to do. And the markets are changing quickly. Even over the course of writing this report, over the past 6 months or so, there have been changes available in the carbon credit with developers. So I think that's a big reason why we're saying that the Wisconsin Forest Carbon Partnership should have a task force that's looking at carbon credits. Like Paul said, with a skeptical eye, and also looking at, you know, under which circumstances in Wisconsin can this be beneficial for carbon sequestration and storage, and can bring in more money to folks as well.
Well, thank you both for joining us and explaining the report.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah. If people would love to continue the conversation, I would suggest that they look at Climate Fast Forward. It's an upcoming conference that we have, not just on forestry, on all sorts of issues related to climate change, mitigation, resiliency, and adaptation in Wisconsin.
Lizzie Condon, Environmental Initiatives Director at the Wisconsin Academy of Sciences, Arts, and Letters. Paul Cole, Tribal Forester for the Stockbridge Muncie Community and Chair of the Wisconsin Tribal Conservation Advisory Council's Forestry Committee. We have a link to their report at wpr.org/mornings. Ahead on the State Capitol Report, we look at the results of new Marquette University Law School poll findings that find a majority of voters believe the state is heading in the wrong direction. Join in, 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The August primary election is August 9th, about 1 month away. The Marquette University Law School poll surveyed registered Wisconsin voters in mid-June for the first time in this election cycle, asking about possible November general election pairings for governor, matching incumbent Governor Tony Evers against each of the top Republican primary candidates. Join in on the August primary, what race you're watching and why, what issues matter most to you at the polls, 800-642-1234. Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
Good morning. A majority of Wisconsin voters believe that Wisconsin is on the wrong track. And I think you've asked a version of the right or wrong direction question dozens of times over the decade in your survey. What's notable this time around?
Well, these are about the most negative views that we've ever seen since, and we've asked it in the deep past, but since 2019, we've seen right direction fall from 57% in January of 2019 to just 37% now. Wrong track, meanwhile, has gone from 33% up to 56% now. And we've seen this really negative view of conditions persisting for a while. All this year, we've seen 39 right direction, then 36, now 37. Wrong track has stayed in the mid-50s, 53, 56, 56. The decline in this started pretty clearly as the first wave of coronavirus hit. Mm. And in fact, just as it hit, we were at a high level. 61% said right direction, 30% said wrong track. But since then, we've seen these numbers come down pretty dramatically. And this is also true in the national picture as well. Both here, when we ask about whether the country's headed in the right direction, and in national polling that asks the right direction question. So this is I've called it a grumpy electorate, and I think that's pretty much right. The electorate generally, whether in Wisconsin or nationally, has a pretty dim view of the direction we're headed.
Sour electorate, grumpy electorate. Is the right direction, wrong track type of question, is that a leading indicator for the party in power? What could it spell?
Well, it's certainly a leading indicator in the sense that no incumbent administration wants the public to think that the country or the state is headed in the wrong direction. And it has, this question has been widely used as that kind of indicator. What's unusual now is that partisans of both parties tend to see the state as headed in the wrong direction. And for different reasons. We are very gloomy about the state of the country right now, but Republicans are gloomy for one set of reasons. Democrats are gloomy from another set of reasons, a different set. And the result is that it's not as easily correlated with partisanship or with the party in power. For example, we have 37% that say the state is headed in the right direction, and only 40% that say Joe Biden, they approve of Joe Biden's job, handling of his job. But in contrast, for Tony Evers, 48% approve. And so there's not a very close connection here in the state between Evers' job approval and the right direction question, you'd think if it was a real leading indicator for this fall, we would see a tighter connection between those two.
You'd see more lockstep in you know, a parallel track in those two questions. But how much does the general mood of the electorate matter politically? What have polls said in the past? You know, what connection can you make there?
Well, I think among the connections there, one is looking for change, you know, in the sense that it may not be directly correlated with the president or a governor's job approval, but when you think things are headed in the wrong direction, if somebody is running that offers you a new direction, that can be appealing. I think the other thing is whether we see high turnout or not in November, or for that matter, in the August primaries. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because if people are really down on the state and the direction we're headed, as with many of these things, you can tell it both ways. If people are down and discouraged and they're not really interested in talking about politics, maybe that lowers turnout in the midterm. On the other hand, maybe this distress about the direction we're headed could boost turnout. At the moment, we're seeing turnout or projected turnout. We're not measuring turnout directly yet, obviously. But we're seeing enthusiasm to vote running about where we would expect it to be in a midterm, which is lower than in any presidential race, but still about as high as we've seen in previous midterms. So on that score, I would say that while being grumpy about the conditions in the country, in the state rather, we're not seeing any depression of turnout, but we're also not seeing any extraordinary boost to turnout related to this question, at least.
What did you make of the enthusiasm gap, though, with 67% of Republicans saying they're enthusiastic to vote compared to 58% of Democrats?
Yeah, and this is something very much worth watching. We had not seen a difference between the two parties until June. In April, it had been 57% of each group were very enthusiastic. Now, in June, there's a 9-point Republican advantage in enthusiasm. That's pretty important because of people who are very enthusiastic. About 93% turn out to vote, while of those who are only somewhat enthusiastic, only about 63% turn out. So there's a real turnout impact if one party's more enthusiastic and if they maintain that through the fall election. So I think that's very much worth watching. The fact that we had not seen a persistent party difference prior to June makes me wonder if we're catching a one-time effect, but it's certainly a boost for Republican spirits and a warning to Democrats that turnout is something they can't take for granted.
Charles Franklin with us, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, unpacking the latest poll. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's look at the U.S. Senate race. Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes leads the pack of Democratic candidates. How are things looking for this race? What did your poll find?
Yeah, here we've seen a consistent top two of Barnes and Lasry. In the June data, Barnes leads that by 4 points, 25 to 21. He had led by 3 points in April and by 10 points in February. So a bit of tightening since February, but really no change since April. Sarah Godlewski is in third place with 9% of the support in June, up from 7% in April. And Tom Nelson at 7% in June, up from 5% in April. And then we asked about the full 11 candidates in the race, but none got more than 1% of the vote. Also 36% who said they hadn't made up their mind in that race. So two clear front runners, a rather distant third and fourth place, not much change in this race, in the margin at least, going back to February. Now we're in the sprint to the August 9th primary. And so now's the time to tune in and make up minds, and for the campaigns to try to influence those minds.
Barnes lacks the personal resources that you would find in, like, multimillionaire Bucks executive Alex Lazary. What impact has money had, and PAC funding have you seen on this race?
Yeah, I think the clear example is that the Lazary campaign has mounted a very extensive advertising campaign, while the Barnes campaign held off on even beginning their advertising early. So Lazary's campaign was doing heavy advertising as early as February, and a little before that even, and has largely continued that campaign. The Barnes campaign held off on even releasing its first ad until fairly late in the spring. I think if you look at these numbers, it may be that the heavy advertising helped Lazary in his growth into a strong second place, rising from 13% in February to 21% in June. Maybe that is significantly the advertising effect. Now we have this last month sprint in which all of the campaigns will have an incentive to spend basically everything they've got in the bank and anything they can raise, because they haven't got a future if they don't get past the August 9th primary.
Sure. Let's bring on a call now. Paul is joining us from Eau Claire. Paul, hi.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
We can, yes.
Here's my question. At what point can a poll be off and you say, well, our poll is no longer newsworthy, or is it news just so slow and hard to come by that there will always be polls, no matter how incorrect they turn out to be?
Paul, thank you. How would you suggest, how do you approach that, as, polls are a snapshot in time? How long do they last, Charles?
Well, it depends. it depends on events. And one of the events is in the Republican race, the dropout of a candidate in since this poll was finished in mid-June. The other is in primaries especially. Awful lot of voters tune in the last week or two or three before the election. I mentioned earlier that 36% were undecided in the Democratic primary. In the Republican primary for governor, we had 32% undecided. Hmm. So clearly there's a lot of room for that to move. If the only interest implied by the question is predicting the outcome, then they have a short shelf life, because predictions will be strongest if they're done a week or two before the election. But our goal here is to monitor the campaign and be able to say how things have changed over time and provide an independent measure of where our candidates are standing, what issues are important to voters. And that process of how that goes from our first polling on this in February until now is the purpose of what we're trying to do. And, if folks are appropriately skeptical about predictions from these, that's perfectly reasonable. Pay attention to the campaigns and what they're saying and respond to them. But hopefully we help clarify how the race has evolved up to this point, and again, what issues are of greatest concern to voters.
Marquette Law and Public Policy Professor, Poll Director Charles Franklin, breaking down the latest Marquette poll that takes the temperature on races heading into the August primary. Join in on how you characterize your enthusiasm for voting, the direction the state is headed, whether your feelings match up with poll results. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment for more State Cap with Charles Franklin here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're discussing the August primary, how voters responded to the latest Marquette University Law School poll that came out a couple weeks ago. Inflation remained the issue voters say they are most concerned about. Does that match up with how you feel? And how does your economic situation translate at the ballot box? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Marquette University Law School poll director Charles Franklin with us for about nine more minutes. Let's look at the governor's race, Charles. The poll results show Tim Michael is essentially tied with former Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish for the Republican nomination for governor. What does the poll results indicate from this race?
Here we saw a clear top two, Michaels and Clayfish, very close together. Unfortunately, Michaels entered the race after our April poll was finished, and so we don't have any comparison on the trend there.
Mm-hmm.
For Clayfish, we did see that she had been in first place in April at 32%, and that fell to 26%, suggesting that Michaels was eating into her support a bit. But that still leaves 21% of his support that he apparently took from other places, especially the don't know, the undecided voters. Now, since this poll was released, Kevin Nicholson dropped out of the race.
Mm-hmm.
He was getting 10%. And in our analysis of the Nicholson supporters, people who had a favorable view of Nicholson, the split in vote choice between Michaels and Clayfish was about even, and the favorability of those two candidates was similar. So it doesn't look like Nicholson supporters, at least as of our June data, were especially more predisposed to go to either Michaels or Clayfish, suggesting that his dropping out may not shift the balance very much. Finally, Tim Rampton is included in the poll. He's fallen to 3% support, down from 4% in April, and one other candidate got less than 1% of the vote.
You also put these candidates head to head with Evers, in this particular poll. What did you find there?
Here, Evers has a small edge against all of them. Excuse me.
Sure.
He leads Clayfish by 4, leads Michaels by 7, and Nicholson by 8, and Rampton by 17. I would consider this a close race, but a little bit of an edge to Evers. The lead over Clayfish is inside the poll's margin of error. It's a little out of the margin for Michaels, but as we said earlier, use these to say how's the race going, not a prediction of certainly not where it'll be in November, but the strengths of the candidates. One thing that's notable is, despite Michael's very heavy advertising, he remains less well known at this point than Clayfish. And so that is something that the campaign will affect through its advertising between now and August 9th. And of course, whoever wins the primary will have a major advertising campaign till November.
Well, I wonder, even with the endorsement he received from former President Trump, whether that would give him a boost.
Well, it may. And Tommy Thompson endorsed Michaels in the
mm-hmm.
last few days.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's certainly possible. Obviously, I can only speak to my own data, which was after Trump's endorsement, but before Thompson
mm-hmm.
made his endorsement. The Michaels campaign has released an internal poll showing them up by, I believe it's 9 points. You have to always be careful about internal polls, because obviously a campaign only releases a poll if they think it would help them. So definitely take that with a grain of salt. We've not seen the Clayfish campaign come back with their own internal polls, and so it's hard to know what they're finding. And haven't seen in the last week any other independent polls in the state by either media organizations or others who might be doing polling in the state. So it'd be nice if we saw something new to tell us whether that claim of the Michaels campaign that they've pushed ahead from that 1-point margin we saw to maybe a high single digits, whether that holds up in other polling.
Talking about public opinion polls with Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, you conducted your June poll before the fall of Roe v. Wade. We've been hearing about, you know, what impact that ruling will have at the ballot box. 538 saying it's too soon to tell if the court's decision will change political winds of the election. What do you think?
Yeah, it's not a clear picture. And our polling between April, before the court's draft opinion was leaked, and June did not show a big boost in enthusiasm for Democrats to vote. In fact, it was the opposite. We saw that boost in Republican enthusiasm to vote. Now, the actual Roe decision and the consequences that are now flowing from that may change that picture when we go back and ask people next time. Some of the national polling has shown Democrats more concerned about abortion as a policy matter, but we've seen inconsistent results on whether it's leading Democrats to say they're more enthusiastic or more certain to vote.
And I want to just jump in here because we are almost out of time, but inflation was the biggest concern on your survey. It's really what's hitting people's pocketbooks.
It is, and it has stayed at the top and just risen since last summer. At this point, 75% say it's the most important issue, and another 20% say they're somewhat concerned about the issue. That drops off with abortion at 58, saying very concerned, and the concern about gun violence at 56%. So those two are the second and third highest concerns, but as you can see, they're well below the level of concern about inflation.
Charles, thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette Law School poll. Just ahead, a dermatologist and a cosmetic chemist discuss how to properly care for our skin through the dog days of summer. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.